Hello and welcome back to the LIBF Trade Finance Podcast. And on today's episode, we are following up with the Q&A from the webinar we've just done on trade-based money laundering key risk indicators. That was with Neil Chantry. Neil and I used to work together at HSBC. When he retired from HSBC, he was the global head of policy and compliance for global trade and receivables finance. He was also the former head of the ICC Banking Commission Executives Committee and chair of the Financial Crimes Compliance Group and former chair of the Wolfsburg Group Trade Finance Working Group. Now, to anybody in trade, that is quite the CV, and we were very lucky to have Neil on today. And we're going to get in with the Q&A, but if you'd like to watch the webinar recording and many others like it, please go to libf.ac.uk/webinars. And to register for our future events, please go to libf.ac.uk/events. And please enjoy this podcast. It came after that. We just done the webinar a few minutes beforehand. Lots of questions. It was really great to see lots of good questions, people interacting from all over the world. And so please enjoy. Welcome to the after party, I think it is, the after show podcast. Thanks very much, Neil. I did take a few notes. And you mentioned about being grilled, and hopefully this is not going to be like like the Senate interrogation you had. I mean, I had the Department of Justice monitor. And I remember at the time, my boss, who will be named, Mark Emerson, you know him well. Yes. He was saying to me, Alex, you know, no jokes, because, you know, maybe he knows what I can be like sometimes. But this was the monitor. He'd coach me, no jokes. And I did struggle, but I was there, Mr. on a level playing field thing.
Yeah.
All he missing. Comes in and starts cracking jokes with the Department of Justice monitor. And I'm like, wait a minute, hold on a minute. So he was basically doing it so that he didn't think I was a funny guy. But but actually, you know, it's about reading the crowd, isn't it? And in that kind of situation, you know, they could see that we were doing well. We were doing a lot of the things, and we definitely felt more comfortable later. And we came out well because we did have a good rapport, but we had a good rapport because we could show everything that we'd done. So you're talking about that. And there were some things where people were not, they don't seem to be doing some of the things. So hopefully this has helped them do that. So you've been helping banks all around the world. So that's really good.
I would hope so, because it makes the industry safer. By making the industry safer, it means that it makes it more difficult for the bad guys and makes it safer for us.
Yeah, so I put a bit on the link. I put I put a link to the transparency index. I always like to talk about transparency index for corruption index from Transparency International.
Yeah.
Partly because Denmark, being half Danish, my mum's Danish, they are number one, but they're joint number one now with New Zealand. So New Zealand, Denmark, and Singapore at number three. But then at the bottom, we've got Somalia, South Sudan, and Syria. What's interesting is the USA has slipped down a few places over the past few years, which is a sort of an interesting thing as well.
You
talked about white goods. It's funny when you talk about white goods, because now I think we have to talk about brushed aluminium goods, because all those things tend to be. I got a new fridge the other day, and there was no option to buy a white one. I had to buy brushed aluminium.
Yeah, well, gone are the days when you can get a green one, a bilious green one, or a black one, or a maroon one, or a white one.
So there was a question from Stephen Murgatroyd saying, surely have a checklist for auditing against. And I want to bring this up because to stress what you were saying later, which was regulators don't like checklists. You might have a red flag list, but it's at the one we had at HSBC, it was like, and anything else.
Yep.
It's not a checklist, is it? Even though people might refer to it, it's not a checklist. And we have to make sure that we stress that, don't we?
Yeah. The thing is that you don't have checklists. What you have is you have guidance lists. And your guidance lists always will have and anything else. And what you should be doing as an operations and as FCC is once a month going through that anything else to see if month on month you are getting something which is coming on a regular basis. And that then gets moved into your checklist, so to speak, and your algorithm. So basically what you're doing is you are always reviewing what's going through your bank, and you are identifying things which are turning into regular occurrences. And therefore you're assessing the risk and you're doing something about it. And if you're doing that and you document that you're doing that, you will be in many respects capable of being able to put cogent arguments up to a bank examiner, a regulator, as to what it is that you're doing, that your program is dynamic. If the program isn't dynamic, it's static, i.e. it is just ticking checkboxes, then you will fail as a bank. Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, one person asked quite an interesting question that I think I was related, you know, we talked about shell companies, and they said, I don't know if you saw that on the chat, it was like, isn't that what Amazon does? And I wasn't sure. I think you maybe understand more of the question, really.
Yeah. Right. So Amazon actually have a compliance department. So if you sign up as an Amazon seller, you have to answer and you have to provide information somewhat similar to opening a bank account, including the fact that you actually have paid taxes or you're not, or whether you are actually liable to pay tax. They will know within your country what the thresholds are, and they will keep a check. I mean, Amazon is like Facebook. It's like Google. It lives off data. Yeah. It feeds off that data and it uses that data and algorithms to identify patterns. It identifies if you're getting lots of returns. It identifies if you're getting a lot of bad reviews. It identifies if your turnovers are getting larger and larger. But you haven't updated your information in respect of tax. So in that respect, Amazon is not a shell company. What it is a marketplace. And marketplaces, although not regulated, know that they have a fiduciary duty to be able to turn around to any regulator and provide information as required if a warrant is presented to them. And so they have to have those things. It's interesting because I just noticed just recently that someone who I knew very well in the days that I was dealing with FATF directly from US Treasury has just joined Facebook as their senior advisor on compliance. Yeah. So the ether world or the e world is rapidly catching up with what the financial world has been under for a long time. When we're talking about these sort of front companies, these shell companies, we're talking about the ones where it's registered at a lawyer's address, or it's registered at at an address where there is a company which deals in managing corporate accounts, i.e. they set up accounts, they become the front directors, but you don't necessarily know who the beneficial owners are or the controllers of the company. And they're not running the day-to-day business. They may ask you to open the letters of credit and things like that on behalf of that, or some of those companies. The reality is that they are not actually those companies, and they are not the beneficial owners, and they are not the beneficial managers. And that's the difference. So if you have, and that's why it's important to look at addresses and to make sure that those addresses aren't in fact companies which are, or places where there is one of these hosting companies that providing the front, if you like, for people who are trying. Frequently, it was used as a way of getting around tax liabilities, which is a predicate offence, and it is illegal, and therefore is covered in FCC requirements. And therefore, the regulators will come after you if you are dealing with them. They are now starting to regulate more the legal profession and the accountancy profession, who have mainly been involved in these things. But I think the US has slipped down because, of course, of Delaware and one or two other states that work on the same model, where you have opaque companies which are managed out of Delaware for tax reasons, and you don't know who the beneficial owners are, and you really don't know where the money source of funds, a source of wealth is of that company.
That's where Biden's from, isn't he? He covers yep. Delaware, doesn't he?
That's right.
Yes. So looking through, we've asked some of the questions, but one person is saying, some of the things you were talking about, they said, what you're asking to do, and this was actually at somebody, so what was nice was people were helping out. There were some questions and somebody were helping us do our job chipping in with things. It was very, it's great. I mean, that's what happens with trade people. They're all like to help each other, especially on this kind of stuff, because nobody wants to see people falling foul of this.
We're a community and we live like a community, a good community.
We might compete against each other, in banking.
Competition is good, but when it comes down to the fundamentals, we work together.
Exactly. That's what I love about trade. But somebody put in about the ICC policy statement on FCC financial crime compliance check on pricing. Mm-hmm. And then somebody else replied, what you're asking to do requires a special task force to check the documents prior to the normal checking as we know it. I don't sort of laugh as it's trivial, but he's kind of, made the point there, because, I saw that when I was at HSBC, the amount of work initially was, we reckon about 40% extra, because a lot of it had to be done manually.
Yep.
Now, of course, there's technological tools, and that's what somebody was asking for an example of some of those things. And what's interesting is that in our conference that is coming up in a month's time, and we'll send out the details for that, we have three sponsors. They have Quantexa, IHS Market, and TradeSun, and they are all technological potential solutions for this arena, all slightly different, but all looking to help banks in that field.
And most people, if they've bought systems from China Systems and people like that, all of these guys already have built interfaces to any of the systems that you want, or even to spreadsheets where they will dump information that you need to do your analysis into spreadsheets, so you can use at the simplest level, so you can use those spreadsheets to do some of the basic review if you haven't got a very substantial FCC underlying data management system.
So there's people sharing different information. I'm just saying there was somebody like,
and the other thing you're looking, but the thing is, yes, in the early stages of doing this, it is very much huge amounts of work. It really is labor intensive, but if you're not doing it and you're not looking to move further into supporting the whole process with automated systems, then it's going to remain labor intensive, and it is going to be hard work, but you have to do it, because if you don't do it, you are in danger of falling foul of the regulators. And if it's not your regulator, it's going to be some other regulator, and they may then tell their banks to refuse to do business with your bank. And that's where all of this thing about de-risking has come in, which has been a major problem for large areas of the world, not just country specific, but regions, whole regions, have found it becoming more and more difficult to get international correspondent relationships, because they haven't got the infrastructures in their financial institution to actually start mitigating the risks of corruption, of financial crime, and of sanctions evasion.
So there's a chap or a person saying about the FCC checks on pricing of goods. Are price checking controls plausible? Now, this is something that comes up regularly, isn't it? And there are various technological tools there.
I know of some banks that say, oh, what we do is we have a link into Alibaba or into other similar e-commerce platforms, and they download particular pricing elements, and then they scroll their customers' transactions against those pricing elements, which is fine. But there are so many, the ICC paper actually points out the number of variables that are involved in the pricing of transactions, the pricing of goods in a trade transaction, which effectively are beyond most algorithms, unless you are able to capture everybody, and I mean literally every corporate, every small company in the world's pricing models. And if you could do that, then you could actually use algorithms to check that the prices were correct. If you use, some people said, why can't you use the customs databases? Most customs databases are relatively inaccessible. There is the US customs database. The problem with the US customs database is that when you do access it, which you can do, you have so many differentials. If you're pricing goods, t-shirts, for example, that have been bought by one of the major retailers, and you're pricing against a particular wholesaler, the difference in volumes and therefore the pricing, the difference in transport, the difference in terms is such that you can't identify what is, even if they came from the same supplier, the same manufacturer, the difference in terms is such that it's very difficult to identify whether it's a true price or not. And so the pricing conundrum is very, very difficult. For those banks that specialize, and they're getting fewer and fewer, in commodities, they have a better chance because they will have people who've been dealing with these commodities and these prices and the markets. And they will understand the dynamics, and they will understand what the prices are that they're seeing and whether they work or not. The reality is, in the vast majority of cases, we haven't got a clue. We can identify where it doesn't make sense. I mean, where you have a very high value motor car, and if you've got a petrol head in your trade finance team, they will know that a Land Rover, a Range Rover Vogue, custom built, is not going to cost £48,000.
It's going to cost exactly that situation when yes, I was in.
It's going to cost £150,000 to £160,000 before you put it on the boat.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. So it's those sort of things where it's glaring, and you should be able to work that one out. That's the sort of things that you can do. But it's making sure that you do have a policy, that you do refer to the ICC paper, and that on a regular basis you see your own customers, are the prices that your customers paying roughly in line with what they've paid before. If they're out of kilter from, if you added in inflation in shipping prices and local prices and currency fluctuations, and the price differential is significantly different, then that is a red flag when you're going back over the transactions and looking at the transaction history. And that's why it's important that you go back and look over transaction history and performance. That's how you find where things are not necessarily correct, and you can then start formulating questions.
Well, there's actually an interesting comment from a lady called Anastasia, mm-hmm. saying it's more of a comment, not a question. Mm-hmm. Actually, with all those checks we have to do in trade finance, we are working more as inspectors than trade finance staff. I think she's obviously taken, you know, a lot of extra work that is being done over yep. the past few years.
But it is true. I mean, the regulators look upon bank staff as being skilled. As I mentioned before, most financial intelligence units, country FIUs, don't have the experience. They look to the banks to actually provide that experience. That's why they rely on us to do the job properly, which is why they lay the work off to us. So yes, we are inspectors. Many, many years ago, in another iteration as an executive trainer for HSBC in Hong Kong, I set up a scheme whereby every year we did a training course for 2 weeks on trade finance and foreign exchange to the Commercial Crime Bureau of the Hong Kong Police.
Yeah.
So that their officers understood what was going on and could actually analyze what was going on and ask sensible questions. And they appreciated it. They loved it.
They're definitely, and I've done some sort of things like that. I saw something for the Central Bank of Nigeria when I was at HSBC. Mm.
Yep.
Now, there's a good point here. There's a chat, well, the person is E118-5860, so we don't actually have his name, but
okay.
He said, good morning, sir. Hope you're keeping well. I am. I hope you are, Neil, too. But it was once said to me that both buyer and seller, applicant and beneficiary, need to be involved in trade-based money laundering, i.e. both will be aware. Is this correct? I'm not so sure it is.
Not always, no. One of the things that there's a group called Gimlet in the UK, which is a public-private sector group, which has been set up by the National Crime Agency, which is our equivalent of the FBI, and the banks, and they send out information from time to time to warn companies about the risks of being used as channels for money laundering. And it's amazing how many companies think that they're making money out of some transactions or acting as a payment conduit for people, and they're getting 10% of the money sent in. They take off 10%, they remit out X amount, you know, so the 90%. Fine, but they warn that this is actually money laundering, and you now are a middleman, and you're likely to go to prison and have all your assets seized and all the rest of it. So both of you don't have to be involved. You don't even have to be both involved in cases of fraud, because I've had cases in my history where only one person was involved in the fraud on somebody else. The other person was the innocent party. So it's not necessarily true, but when you're talking about big schemes, where they are, the one I talked about was where the furniture importer was effectively taken over by the bad guys, and the normal business kept on going, but all of the extra business that was coming through was voluminous. I mean, it was huge, and even the bank involved had started asking questions, and that was when the regulators and the enforcement authorities decided that they could act, because now they actually had the full picture of what was going on, and by having the full picture, they were able to then to act and close it all down. But you know, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for changing in patterns. You're looking for changes in activity in the company.
Got one last question here, which is kind of slightly related to that. Is, you know, it's how broad a search are you doing? So this is Chandan, who's saying, in a commodity trade between two traders, sometimes we do not know the source of goods as well as previous parties to those goods. Mm. How many previous transactions should be scrutinized by a bank? I mean, it's a good question, because it's, I don't think there's not a set answer. Like, you can't say that many.
No.
Because it's about making yourself comfortable or uncomfortable, isn't it? You know,
it is. I think the key thing is you should always know the origin. Should always insist on knowing the origin and having, as part of the documentation, proof of origin. And then you can check to see whether that's a fraudulent document, because you will know what sort of document you would expect to get. And are you getting that document? And does it make sense? Does it make sense for that transaction and for the volume? But you have to be very careful. I know when in commodities, because it's multiple times sold before it even gets to the final user. And that's one of the other things that the regulators keep on asking, is about who's the final user. So for certain things, you can always say, well, I know who the final user is because I'm selling it. It's being financed to this guy, and this guy is then going to manufacture such. Then he's going to sell it to these people, and they're going to be the final users. And I see that because I know the relationship and I'm financing bits of it. But when it's a commodity trade, it is different. And what you should be doing is you should be looking at your counterparties. Don't just trade with anybody. You need to identify who your counterparties are and rigorously understand their structure, who they are and what they do, and make sure that you're not dealing with somebody who is, well, if they're new to the game, then you would treat them with a certain amount of circumspection anyway, I would have hoped.
Yeah.
And if they're old to the game, there should be transaction histories you've done with them before, where you know that they are what they always used to say in the old days, honest brokers. So, you know, it's the due diligence on your counterparties are the most important, and who you sell to. If you're the middle, if you're another middleman, you have to know who you're buying from and who you're selling to, and you have to understand their bona fides and accept that you know them well enough to be able to accept that transaction. In other words, that you're going to buy from them at that rate, and then you've got a counterparty who you know well, who you have got all your due diligence on, who you are going to sell on. A number of the big commodities traders now have their own compliance departments who are ex-bankers and lawyers. And they are, you know, some of them now, because they know that they could be put out of business if they got on the wrong side of any of the big regulators. So if they really upset the US, they're out of business.
Yeah.
So they tread very carefully.
And you know, maybe some of these people want to join us at our annual Trade Finance Compliance Conference. See the way I segued in there?
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean,
quite good with it.
There's a lot of expertise there. There's some very good subjects going to be discussed. And it's an opportunity to hear a range of what's going on. I mean, one of the sessions, which is always people like, is the one that where they're talking about issues that are happening now. So yeah. We've got John Turnbull, who's involved in what's going on with the Singapore oil issues. So that's commodities. There are people who are going to be able to talk and address a lot of things that a lot of you are involved in or you see on a day-to-day basis and probably would like to know a bit more about.
No, and hopefully we get, you know, the same kind of thing. I mean, in fact, we need to think about it at the conference because we don't always have time for all the Q&A. So maybe there's a thing we should be doing like we're doing now, sort of addressing some of the Q&A to the side. Because with all these things compliance related, you tend to run out of time. And I think we've actually kind of done that now. Mm. We're going to have to close up now. We've addressed all the questions that were asked.
Okay.
So that's cool. But, you know, the subject matter, it's we've done a little, like an hour with your webinar. But, you know, with the conference, it's 3 hours over 2 days.
Yeah.
That'll probably won't cover it all either. So no,
it's 6 hours over 2 days, 3 hours and 3 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yes. Sorry. So, well, thanks very much, Neil.
No problem.
And thanks to our events team. We've had Rox, Annabelle, and now we've got Christian involved. So thanks to them. Without the, you know, you need the people in the background, the road crew doing all this stuff. So thanks to them. And we'll see you all soon enough. Thanks very much.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. Yeah.